Social media is a mixed bag. We know this. That friend from high school with the perfect Facebook feed full of happy, smiling faces is often not sharing the full scope of daily life. The meltdowns, the heartaches, the messy. We know this, and yet how easily we forget. Social media can be so hard. And yet sometimes, it can be the perfect space to find community, build your advocacy, and change the face of disease. Welcome to WonderCast, a community collaborative podcast supporting families navigating the complexities of chronic illness or injury. WonderCast is supported by the generous sponsorship of Texas Oncology. Texas Oncology, more breakthroughs, more victories, experts in cancer care. November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month, and we are so excited to introduce you to Leah Phillips and Bianca Bai, founders of the Young Lung Cancer Initiative. Tune in and learn more about this incredible group and the work they are doing with advocacy, research initiatives, and building a community of hope. This is Leah and Bianca.
So, like Julie said, my name is Leah, and I am born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky. I was diagnosed in December of 2019, with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer with the genetic mutation of EGFR exon 19 deletion. This was a complete shock because I had no known risk factors for lung cancer at all and actually never smoked. When I was diagnosed, I had 3 kids that were 9, 13, and 14. And it was a delayed diagnosis due to, you know, I didn't fit the typical bill of a lung cancer patient. So it took about 4 months to be diagnosed and 2 hospitalizations and all sorts of things, but finally got that diagnosis and was quickly able to get started on treatment. And from there, I've done really well, definitely having lots of treatment consistently, radiation, surgery, et cetera. And what brought me to the advocacy world was losing a friend that was only 32. She was diagnosed at 30, passed away at 32. And I thought something has to be done better and more for people that are not the typical lung cancer patient or what we think is the typical lung cancer patient. And so I advocated at a local level. And then Bianca and I met online in one of the EGFR patient groups and just had this real passion for helping people diagnosed with lung cancer at 50 or younger, still raising families, still building their careers. So we just started the very grassroots, and it's just grown and grown and grown because there's such a need for just support for those of us that are diagnosed under 50.
Absolutely. Bianca, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name's Bianca, born and raised in Massachusetts. My connection with lung cancer is in February 2023. My mom went to the emergency room with back pain, thinking she had a UTI that turned into a kidney infection. But essentially, she was diagnosed with lung cancer and passed away 3 weeks later, essentially never came home. It was just a really quick and shocking situation. I was 14 weeks pregnant the time she died. And 5 months later, my dad developed a cough, and he, you know, it was, oh, it's lung cancer. It's lung cancer. Your mom just died of it. And dad, you don't have lung cancer. You're so healthy. And you go to the doctors all the time. Well, long story short, the day I delivered my daughter, my dad was diagnosed with stage 4 EGFR lung cancer, same as Leah. He unfortunately passed away this past May. And through all that, I just became involved in advocacy because it was just such a whirlwind and I was thrown into this world and I was trying to understand it. And I met so many people who were kind of similar age as me or having babies, but actually being the ones diagnosed with it versus like a caregiver. And it just really, I don't know, just shook me to my core that this was happening. And I had no idea, you know, at all. And like Leah is very passionate about bringing awareness to this population and supporting their kind of unique needs. And here we are with Young Lung Cancer Initiative.
I think when you hear about lung cancer just in general, you're right, that does come across just to the common listener, probably as an older person's disease. And your organization is highlighting specifically that that is not the case. Why don't we start by talking about Young Lung Cancer Initiative? How did this incredible group grow?
It really has evolved naturally, kind of very quickly over time. It started out as a private Facebook group where patients could just kind of talk amongst themselves and share their situations, fears, concerns, questions about raising children, work, cashing out 401k, all of those things that they have to now think about prematurely. And then from there, it came out to like, okay, well, we should start social media and just bring a voice to that, bring awareness to that, that this is happening and we're here. And like everyone with lung cancer deserves better treatment options. But like this population's invisible, like we need to make people aware of it. And then it turned into kind of thinking about what their unique needs are in terms of like maybe financial assistance, webinars, education, bringing updates about relevant research to our community, like kind of all of these things. And through that, we've kind of developed different educational programs, patients sharing their stories with Leah and a conversation about their own experiences. And we've provided financial support during holiday season or kind of helped with like bucket list items to give patients unique experiences. So it's kind of just evolving. And, you know, Leah's gone to conferences to share her story and represent our population. So it's just really at the heart of it is about representation, but also meeting their needs.
I would agree. And I think because lung cancer comes with such a stigma, you know, the average age is like 65-year-old white man, and none of us in our group fit that qualification at all, nor do we qualify for any, you know, early detection screening because most of us do not have a history of tobacco use. Or even if you take that out of it, we're not old enough. We don't qualify by age for that early detection screening. So like Bianca said, going to conferences, I went to World Conference on Lung Cancer, I guess, 2 years ago. And I think it was the first time that someone, being me, said, I am young. I do have lung cancer. We deserve to be seen and heard, and we want shared decision making. And I think, you know, we talk about three words that are important to us are visibility, empowerment, and hope. You know, we're trying to bring visibility to, that this does happen. We want people out there in the world to know, even if they don't have any of those traditional risk factors for lung cancer, if you have lungs, you are at risk for lung cancer. First of all, you know, empowering patients to advocate for themselves with their physicians, to stand up and tell their story without shame. And then hope, because when I was diagnosed, I was told very dismal, just terrible statistics, you know, 6 to 12 months of life, then it upped it to 2 years, then they said 5 years. And, you know, when you have children and you're, you know, young and that's not really on your radar, it really shakes you. And to have some piece of hope, oh, someone is doing well on this. Somebody is living a normal-ish life, doing the things they want to do with the people they love, even though they have a stage 4 cancer diagnosis. Because the majority of us are diagnosed late stage because your lungs don't have nerve endings. Therefore, you're not feeling pain in your lungs when it starts. And it's usually because kind of the horse is out of the barn and it's spread to, you know, either your lymphatic system, your bones, it's already progressed.
Yeah. And I'll add to that too. I think we're hoping we're reaching healthcare professionals as well, because a major issue in our community is many go to a doctor 10, 15 times with persistent symptoms before a CT scan is even ordered. And sometimes they'll get an x-ray, but that is really not the best way to have imaging of the lungs. You know, the most conclusive way, they, you know, it might not show up on an x-ray, or it may show up, but you can't really tell what it is. So then they're like, well, it's pneumonia, and then you're treated with antibiotic after antibiotic. So that's the other thing is, it's not like if you have these symptoms, that means you have lung cancer. But I think if you have persistent symptoms that aren't going away, it's really important for doctors or healthcare professionals to include that in their differential diagnosis. And I think it's really important for patients to feel empowered to say, I need you to rule out that this is malignant. We want more people to be able to catch this disease early. And of course, it's not always related to healthcare professional or situations. A lot of it is because you don't feel symptomatic until it's later, so you wouldn't know. But there is that other piece of it where people are crying for help and, you know, it's taking too much legwork.
I think it's pretty incredible how your organization is growing that voice for people that may not know how to advocate for themselves or may have limited resources or live in communities that are not near healthcare hubs, to be able to feel like, I am not alone in this. This is what other people are saying and doing. Coming from that healthcare background, it's very comfortable, not even very comfortable, because it's even weird to advocate in terms of child life with providers or with other clinicians. But having that awareness is so important. Do you feel like your platform allows for other people to be like, wow, I now have the tools. I now know what to say.
Absolutely. Bianca and I, not only do we have this patient group that you know, it's got lots of involvement. I think we have like 3,000 members in our patient and caregiver group. But on a daily basis, we get individual messages from patients and caregivers asking questions. And quite often people will say, I've just been diagnosed with, you know, non-small cell lung cancer. I'm seeing an oncologist for the first time next week. What do I ask? Where do I go? We get a lot of questions about where should I get a second opinion? Should I get a second opinion? Different types of treatments, because a lot of it's not cut and dry, like, oh, you have this, you take this. Now, it's good that there's more options, but sometimes it's like a question of, well, you could do the standard of care or there's these other options. And, you know, they're in a just a haze or a fog of, I've just been diagnosed with this disease. I've been told is terminal. I can't think straight. And I need somebody who's got some kind of knowledge or experience to kind of help me formulate these questions. And then, of course, what I find being in Kentucky, and we have a lot of rural areas where people just don't understand. They don't even understand what it means to have non-small cell lung cancer. When you say, have you had biomarker testing done to see if you've got a genetically driven cancer, they don't even know what that is. So it's a lot of mentoring to help people along their path so that they do get the best possible care available.
And I will say, too, that I've also received messages of, hey, I want to let you know 3 months ago, I saw one of your videos and I pushed for a biopsy or a CT scan, and I just got the diagnosis. It is lung cancer. It's stage 1 or 2. So like, thank you so much. Or the other of like, it wasn't going away, and thankfully it came back as benign or precancerous, and we're going to watch it or whatever it is, right? But they're like, I have such peace of mind now that I know. And that will be people that like weren't on our radar as like community members, you know, just people from afar that were helping. Every time it just kind of shocks me to just, like, this didn't exist a year and some change ago, you know, like a year and a half ago. And of course, there are many great resources for lung cancer, but I think our social media has really grown and has reached general population, which I think is tough to do when you're like in the advocacy world talking about a very niche subject, right? So I think the fact that we've been able to do that through storytelling and creating a community of patients that feel now empowered and safe enough to share is really actually changing individual experiences and hopefully starting to shift the perception of lung cancer.
If people are wanting to connect, maybe as either supporting somebody who has lung cancer or even in a provider, a clinician that's working in that population, what is the best way for them to find you guys on social media, on a website? What's the best way for them to connect?
I would say our website, ylci.org, definitely has kind of links to all our social media. Our YouTube has a lot of great educational content in terms of patients sharing their experiences in like a longer form setting, webinars on like treatment options, different oncogenes or mutations. And then, you know, they could reach out through the website, through YouTube. There's the link to the Facebook group. Our Instagram is at Young Lung Cancer. So kind of anywhere, we're kind of all over the place. The Facebook group is probably the best way if they're looking for more kind of immediate support, because that way, if like Leah and I can't get back to them right away, if they post in the group and ask a question, the community like runs itself. It is really wonderful how supportive, you know, these patients have so much going on in their own lives, but they still take the time to kind of respond to someone that's newly diagnosed or facing progression.
And I think you have a unique subset of people that have also experienced a unique type of fatigue. So when you go to these appointments, 15, 16 appointments, and you're having all of these conversations with providers saying, I don't feel well, something is wrong. And then to finally get the assessment and it come back, oh, not only do you have something, you have stage 4 or even any late stage. I feel like that is just a unique subset of almost grief and anger and frustration.
Yeah. So when, you know, I was going through this period of going to the doctor, I mean, I was health conscious. I was a runner. I ate right. I had mammograms. I did my skin checks, like all the things that I could do to make sure that I was as healthy as could be, I was doing. And so to keep going back to the doctor and saying, something is not right, something is not right. I think the worst diagnosis I received was anxiety. Like, okay, we don't know what it is. We've told you all the other things that we can think of. So we'll just say it's anxiety. And then, you know, to finally be admitted to the hospital for a second time and find out that there is all this pleural effusion, they drain the fluid off my lung and it is malignant, but still not knowing where it's coming from. In that 24 to 36 hour period, you know, I was devastated because I knew it was late stage. It was, you know, it spread and metastasized because I had lytic lesions or, you know, bone mets in my spine that could be seen at this point. But I kept thinking, okay, it's going to be breast cancer. It's going to be ovarian cancer. Maybe it's colon cancer. Like, we can deal with these things. Like, but when the doctor came in to tell me it was lung cancer, I literally sat there thinking they've gone into the wrong room. I was on the oncology floor, but I was sitting there thinking, I don't know why he's telling me this. He needs to go next door. Because the first thing people associate is smoking. And I knew I had never done that. I didn't even know that I was at risk for smoking. You know, nobody in my family had smoked. I didn't grow up around smoke. I was a teacher. I wasn't with harsh chemicals. So you kind of get hit with all that. And it's just such a surreal feeling. Plus then I think because of the stigma of lung cancer, you almost feel shame. Like, because people are always asking, you know, when I got out of the hospital, oh, well, how long did you smoke? When did you quit smoking? Are you still smoking? There's all that. There is looking at your 9-year-old who's excited about his birthday, his 10th birthday, even though it's 7 months away, and is saying, I can't wait. This is the kind of party I'm going to have. And looking him in the eye and thinking, I might not even be there for this 10th birthday. It is absolutely devastating. All the things that you thought your life was going to be like kind of change in the blink of an eye. And I will say when that happens, like I kind of mentally shut down. Like there was only so much grief and trauma that your mind can handle. So thankfully, my husband kind of stepped in and started as a caregiver researching, who do we get a second opinion with? What are our options? Reaching out to people that he had found online, because you are in such a state of shock. And, you know, you kind of go through I say it's like a cycle of grief, because like when someone dies, it's like, you know, it's sadness, it's anger, it's denial, it's acceptance. But for this type of a diagnosis, I feel like it's a continual cycle, because as maybe you progress or maybe treatment stops working or you're having really bad side effects, you kind of start the cycle again. So it's one of those things that takes your breath away and you sit there and think, how is this my life? I mean, even I'm almost 6 years out now, and there'll be times, like I was at Disney World just a few days ago, and I was sitting there and there was tons of people everywhere, and I was waiting for my husband and my son, and I'm looking at all these people and I'm like, you know what? Here I am amongst all these people and no one knows how sick I really am. And I'm sure there were other people like that out there too, but it's just a really odd feeling of just being alone in a situation, because it's not a cancer a lot of young people can relate to. So I think we've done a good job with normalizing your feelings around this, saying it's okay to be mad. It's okay to be disappointed. It's okay to be sad. This is a form of grief. It's a lot to take in. It is a whole lot to take in. I remember being diagnosed in the hospital a few days before Christmas. So it was still, I had to jump right back into mom mode and make sure that Christmas went out without a hitch and that the kids got to their practices and teacher gifts were wrapped and all the things that you do, you don't just get to stop. So you have to learn to live through all of this.
Do you feel like the advocacy that your group is doing has helped increase the different research and availability of treatments for people in the community?
I mean, I really do. I think we're hitting the tip of the iceberg. When I was diagnosed almost 6 years ago, there was no term young onset lung cancer. That wasn't even a term at all. And now it is very common. If you go to ASCO or World Conference on Lung Cancer, it's young onset lung cancer or young onset colon cancer. So this being diagnosed at 50 or younger is now making a mark on the map. There have been certain physicians, oncologists, different research hospitals that have really like embraced that, two of which are either one has and one is starting a dedicated clinic for young onset lung cancer patients, which is monumental because there was nothing like that. We're a new type of patient. I've talked to other thoracic oncologists that say, you know, we care just as much for our 75-year-old lung cancer patient. But at 75 years old, what they're wanting out of life is different than what somebody who's 40 or 30 or 20 or 46, you know, they can sit there and say, you know, I've lived a good life. I've seen my children grow. Whereas those of us that are not in that age group do have this like zest for, I need to be here for this. I want to be here for this. I will do anything and everything to try to be here for this. And I think that the oncologists are really embracing that. You know, we're actively trying to find better and asking the questions and researching. And
Bianca, I know that your family is the perfect testament to how cancer can manifest differently in bodies your mom from diagnosis to end of life was this short frame, and then you did have more years with your father. Do you feel like the families that you're connecting with through the organization, are they primarily people that are now being gifted more time because of better options for treatment or better awareness? Or do you feel like it's kind of still all over the map?
So with lung cancer in patients that are younger or don't have a risk factor of like smoking, I'd say like 75% have, they're called oncogenic drivers, which are mutations that just exist in the cancer cells. They're not inherited. And those drivers can be usually targeted with a targeted therapy, like a pill, some are infusion. And those treatments typically have better quality of life, for sure, if it's a pill. And survival is not anywhere where it needs to be, but it's in years versus months. I'd say the hardest thing from someone who is so inside of it all, but also outside in terms of not living with the disease, is to see the range in responses, right? And it's really hard to wrap your head around because, sure, we can say it's because they have this co-mutation or they have metastasis in this organ or this or that, that make, you know, worse prognostic factors, but it doesn't always play out that way either. And you have people that get 6 months on first-line pill, and then you have people like Leah, thankfully, that are still doing well almost 6 years later on first-line treatment. And it's really hard to kind of reconcile and watch that. And even my dad, right, they thought with his treatment, he'd get probably a little over 2 years on his first-line treatment. It worked for a few months, basically. And he lived 18, 19 months after starting treatment. You know, so it's just, there's a range, but I do think there's also a lot of hope and people are living longer and better lives.
Yeah. There's definitely survivor's guilt almost that comes along with being successful. I'm thankful that I've been so successful, but it is very hard, especially the longer we do this and the more relationships we build with these people that have the same exact mutation as I do, or were diagnosed at the same age. Both of us were runners or whatnot. And then, you know, maybe they only get 6 months on the treatment, where here I am almost 6 years later. But along with that, I take that as a great gift. And that's why I do what I do, because so many people don't have the quality of life or the length of life that I do, where they can like really dedicate so much time to advocacy. And that's why I am like, somebody's got to do it. I'm going to do it because I can, at least right now.
You know, I think that's what's so, you know, amazing about Leah is she's using her, I don't want to say good fortune because this is, you know, not good fortune, but using her response as a way to get her story out there and empower others. Because lung cancer, I think because of stigma, but also because people don't live very long and are diagnosed late stage, we don't have a lot of advocates. And the reason I think I've stepped up is because it can't fall on stage four patients to carry all of it. Like, there's so many wonderful patients with stage four that do get involved and do dedicate so much of their time to advocacy. I think it gives purpose, meaning, all of those things for some people. And that's like a very personal decision. But I really think like it's so important for caregivers to kind of step up, or people that have early stage diagnosis and are doing well and treated with curative intent, to get involved, because stage four is a roller coaster. I mean, any cancer diagnosis is a roller coaster, but advanced stage disease, an absolute roller coaster. You're dealing with scans every 6 to 12 weeks, you know, and you're scared every time, and there's anxiety every time, and you can't focus on certain things. So we just want to foster compassion for all of lung cancer. It's just really weird when you try to like take a stance or put out a perspective of a young person or someone who has this disease and doesn't understand why people have opinions on it. And it is
kind of crazy. And, you know, it doesn't just affect the person. You know, my kids are old enough to follow our stuff on social media. And I know my kids have had a hard time saying my mom has lung cancer, because then they get the question, well, did she smoke? Were you around her when she smoked? Do you think you're going to get lung cancer? So it affects everyone. And no one deserves any type of cancer at all. And, you know, we're just trying to bring a new light. I mean, if you look at cancer just in general, more and more people are being diagnosed at younger ages. Why is this happening? What is causing this? It's a global issue. It's just lung cancer is one, like Bianca said, people did not think that they were at risk for at all, based on either their choices or their age. And that's just not the truth. That's what we're trying to bring a light to, is because it is a real issue.
These people that are living with this, they do need the resources. They do need the voice and the tools and the community. And I love that you guys are creating that. And spreading it at a national level. What exciting things do you have coming ahead for your organization?
Well, we have lots of exciting things going on right now. Well, we're very excited about partnering with some other nonprofits like Wonders and Worries to help our patient population, because so many of us do have children. And like, how do you broach that subject with your children? How much do you share? When do you share? Those kind of things. We have another partnership with another nonprofit that helps adults, but patients, caregivers, children of previvors of cancer express and deal with the emotional mental load through art therapy, which is great. We've talked a lot about oncogene or genetically driven lung cancers. And, you know, that's kind of a, not a new thing, but a newer thing to the lung cancer world. And, you know, there's several that are targetable like EGFR and ALK positive and ROS1. And so we're doing series on each one of those so that when someone gets that diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer, they know to ask for the testing to see if they do have an oncogene driven cancer. And then what does it mean to live with that? So it's like a patient giving their experience. There's a professional, like a doctor or researcher, talking about the mechanics and the science part of it. Just really trying to educate anybody and everybody that's able to hear. There is hope and there are resources, because a lot of us go to community hospitals where you see a general oncologist who are wonderful. And I have the utmost respect for them, because I don't know how you walk in one room and talk to somebody about breast cancer. The next room is prostate. Next room is lung cancer. Then you're talking to melanoma and keeping all that straight. Just they're extremely intelligent people. But, you know, it's hard to be an expert on every little thing. And even if they feel like they're an expert on lung cancer, now with these individual oncogene driven cancers, they're all different. I think that's kind of what we're excited about, at just reaching more people, providing our patient population with resources. You know, we can't be good at everything. We can't do it all, but we can help align people with the people they need, the support they need.
Our content is, I think, for anyone, especially our educational content, like it's, yeah, some of it may be related to having kids or being early in your career, but it's kind of for anyone that wants to learn or is diagnosed with certain types of lung cancer.
Nothing feels better than being able to have someone ask a question, right? And then be like, oh my gosh,
I know,
I have something for you. Let me, and it's an immediate send. As a mom and a clinician who's like juggling all the things like we all are, it's kind of like you can see it and do it right then. And I feel like it's so nice to have those tools readily available at your hands.
Yeah. As a social worker, that is like in my bones, like resources, like I need to find a resource, like I need to have it, you know, and it's like, it feels so nice.
When I was diagnosed, there wasn't that one spot. If our website having all of the people we partner with, and we keep everything that we record on our YouTube channel. You can go through and click and start and stop and watch and go back. It's just send it to your family. I mean, I send videos to my parents all the time because they're like, I don't understand what you're talking about when you say you have such and such, you know, so it's just nice to have everything housed together.
Absolutely.
I think as a patient, my biggest advice is I have never been or felt so alone as when I was first diagnosed. I didn't know anyone with lung cancer. I didn't know anyone, definitely my age, with lung cancer. I was worried about myself, but more so I was worried about my children. Like, how do I help them? But I also wanted to soak in all this content, but I didn't want to have to vet whether it was valid or not. You know, it was just Joe Schmo saying his idea, or if it was a physician from MD Anderson, you know, telling the information. I think my biggest piece of advice is, you know, find a resource that you can trust. And take it in as you can. I was not able to take some of it in at first. I would send it to my husband. Can you read this and let me know if this is something that would work? Or I would send it to my sister and say, can you read this? Is this something that I need to pay attention to? And just know that there are people out there willing to help you and willing to talk to you. There are other people like you out there, and there is hope. Try not to just Google. Try to find that reliable resource where you can trust what people are saying and make connections. You don't have to be like me where you're putting it all out there on social media. You can be very private about it in that patient group, but you can still get the help that you need or the reassurance.
And Bianca, as a caregiver or someone who's supporting someone who's facing this illness, what advice do you have for them?
Finding support, connecting with others who can understand is really important. But I also think like it's okay to take breaks, because it's a cancer group or these are cancer resources. There are things that are going to come up that are going to be triggering. They're going to talk about progression or someone passing away. And I will say that's something that's very important to us, is once you're a part of our community and your family is, you're always a part of our family, and we will honor and acknowledge those that have passed in our community. So I think allowing yourself to take space too is really important. You don't have to know every single nuanced detail about your loved one's cancer. You're not, you know, like in charge of the Human Genome Project, where sometimes I like to think I was and would like analyze every, I could probably tell you my dad's like genomic panel, like, and he had a lot of mutations, you know, top to bottom. And a lot of that is just noise that's not clinically relevant. Nobody knows how you're going to respond to treatment, how long you're going to, or how long your loved one is, or what this mutation means or this metastasis means. Like, sure, there's research and general understanding of these things, but equip yourself with knowledge so you can advocate. You don't have to go into the weeds.
Listening to you both talk, I've just been sitting here in awe of how much you know, your knowledge base for this disease and the variances of the disease and the different types of oncotypes, and is unbelievable. And truly a testament to the work that you guys are doing with your advocacy. And I think it's an important thing for someone who's listening that wants to come on board or come partner alongside. Like, it's okay to say, hey, I don't understand everything, but I want to learn, or I want to be a part of it, or I want to promote this information so that it can get into more of the hands of the people that are experts in that, for supporters and providers and other people that aren't living with the disease, to know that you don't have to know everything. Just be present. Be kind, be collaborative.
Find a team that gives you space to ask questions and is willing to kind of talk these things through with you.
You know your body better than anyone else. You know how you feel more than anyone else does. Just when you know something's not right, just be persistent. Don't let somebody telling you, oh, it's just anxiety, deter you from continuing to seek answers. You have to be your own best advocate.
And I would say ask for help. You know, I think people that have younger children are used to like kind of doing it all and being super mom or super dad. And this is absolutely life-altering. Any serious illness is. And your community wants to be there for you and your loved ones.
Thank you for tuning into our podcast today. Please subscribe and continue to check back as our content is ever evolving. For questions or specific content-related requests, please send an email to podcast@wondersandworries.org.